Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, February 28th, 2017, 1:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Last day of February 2017. Can you believe that? I cannot imagine that we are 21 days away from the first day of spring. What a quick winter it has been. Just seems like it was Christmas yesterday. As many of you know, this week we lost a television legend, to be sure. And there's the music. This music was heard by so many people and still continues to be heard by people to this day. 1981 to 1993, really one of the first reality shows on television, The People's Court, presided over by the legendary Judge Joseph Wapner. And sadly, Judge Wapner left us on Sunday at the age of 97. What a great long life he led. Judge Wapner was a many-time guest on this program, and we appreciated it every time he came on. I thought his take on the law and the law shows of the time were impeccable. So this hour, we are going to remember a man who we certainly liked a whole lot, and a lot of us grew up with, or certainly, if not grew up with, was a part of our lives. Before we get to our guest, and we have a very special guest who knew the judge very well, we are going to go to a report filed by CNN on the passing of Judge Joseph Wapner.
A recipient of the Purple Heart and the Bronze Star for his service in World War II, Joseph Wapner, the famed television judge, lived his life with honor and purpose. Best known for his role in the courtroom series The People's Court, he was the first star of reality courtroom television.
The essential terms of the contract were not there. You have to have a meeting of the minds.
Born November 15, 1919 in Los Angeles, Wapner pursued his education at the University of Southern California for both his undergraduate degree and his law degree. In between his studies, he served in the U.S. Army, reaching the rank of lieutenant. Before presiding over his TV courtroom, he served as a Los Angeles County Superior Court judge for 20 years. After retiring, Wapner was the president of the California Judges Association for 2 years. It wasn't until after he left that position that Wapner followed in his father's footsteps, an attorney who occasionally made on-air appearances, and became the first presiding judge of the People's Court in 1981.
Take a short recess, I'll come back, give you my decision.
Wapner's run on the People's Court was the first in the reality courtroom TV genre, inspiring decades of courtroom shows and other TV judges, including Judge Judy. He taped more than 2,000 episodes of the People's Court during his 12-year tenure. Wapner was a husband, a father, and a recipient of a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
And a many-time guest on this program, as I said. Joining us to remember him is one of the trio of on-air personalities we saw each and every day on the People's Court back then, along with Rusty the Bailiff, Doug Llewellyn. Joining us today is Doug Llewellyn to remember his friend, Judge Joseph Wapner. Doug, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing good, Scott. That was interesting hearing that. Nice to hear it. So how are you?
I'm doing very well. It's good to hear from you, Doug. Before we get to the judge, a lot of people have been asking me, what has Doug Llewellyn been up to?
Well, I got news for I do a lot of things and have done a lot of things. But what you may not know is, since September, I've been back on the People's Court after a 22-year absence.
I had read something about that. I haven't got a chance to watch it yet. I'm going to have to do it now.
Yeah, you will. I don't think that's ever happened before. Anybody work on a television series and then come back again to find the series still on the air 22 years later. That's what's really astonishing. Technically, the People's Court right now is in its 32nd year on the air. That's pretty phenomenal.
How did it come to pass that you were invited back?
You'd have to ask the executive producers of that, who are good friends of mine, obviously, because I worked with them for the first 12 years of the series, since the very beginning. And, you know, over the course of years, and I work in this industry, I've worked in the motion picture industry heavily. I've done a lot of producing of major television shows. I've done a lot of corporate television. And, I mean, I've been very active. I've been very lucky, quite frankly. And I would occasionally have lunch with the executive producers in Los Angeles And every now and then they would mention, geez, Doug, maybe we ought to bring you back to the show. To be honest with you, when the series went off in 1994, the ratings had weakened somewhat on the show, and Warner Brothers made the decision to take it off the air for a while, always thinking maybe in 4 or 5 years they'd bring it back again. Well, it was 2 years later that Judge Judy came on the air. And they decided then, a year after Judy had debuted, to bring the People's Court back to compete with Judge Judy, who was taping her series in Los Angeles. So in order to get away from the same cases that Judy was selecting from, they moved the series to New York, and they picked a whole new team. They picked a new judge. They picked a new guy to do what I was doing, introducing the cases and interviewing them after the show, and a new bailiff. And that was fine. That's the way they made that decision to do it. And, you know, if I'd have been the producer, I may have done the same thing. And it just worked out that eventually they gave me a call one afternoon and asked me if I'd be willing to come back to the series. That was about a year ago right now. And I said, you know, it might be fun to come back. And I've enjoyed being back. It's a lot of fun. And it hasn't changed. Same kind of thing, same kind of lawsuits, same kind of disputes, same kind of people. It's like, you know, deja vu. It's all over again, the same thing. Obviously, as far as the litigants are concerned, now we have a different judge. We don't have Judge Wapner, who was, no question, a legend in his own time. We have Judge Marilyn Mullion right now, who is, she's fabulous. She's different from Judge Wapner, as Judge Judy is different from Judge Wapner. They all have their own styles, but it was an honor to be associated with Judge Wapner in the very beginning on something that was a real experiment when we started in 1981. We had no idea how that show was going to be received, it just took off.
You know, Doug,
I mean, within 6 weeks, there were front page stories in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and magazines all about this new, unique court show that for the first time was bringing real litigants with a real dispute before a real judge who issued a binding verdict. There had never been anything like that on television before, and, you know, it didn't take long for the People's Court to become a bona fide hit, and before you know it, we had 20 million people a week watching that show. And Judge Wapner became the most famous judge in America. Hands down.
Without question. Something that was fascinating to me, because I got a chance to interview the judge 4 or 5 times later on in his life, was he told me that when the original series ended, it was on from 81 to 93, he said nobody had called to tell him it had ended. And his brother-in-law told him, I think is what he said. And he was bitter. I guess maybe bitter is not the right word. He was happy for the experience he had had, but just surprised that he never got a call. Were you informed that the original series had ended? I was always curious about that.
Well, you know, I would challenge that a little bit, because we had a wrap party.
Oh.
We knew the series was going to be... Well, really what happened is that Warner Brothers decided that they were going to try an experiment for a year. We had all of these cases that had been taped and shows that had been produced for 11 years. And they decided to do a year of repeats because they had done research and had come to the conclusion that the repeats would do as well in the ratings as the original episodes were doing. So that's what happened. We ceased production of original episodes, but the series went on for another year of all repeats. So after we finished taping the final of the new shows that we're doing, we had a big wrap party. And Judge Wapner was there. And then the series continued on the air, and we all knew it was going to be on. And then, you know, the thought was we'd probably come back and continue doing live episodes the following year. We were going to take a year off from producing live shows. Well, what actually happened was when they started running the repeats on the air, it turned out that the majority of the audience recognized so many of those cases, thinking they had seen them before, and logically what happened is the ratings started to really go down. And when they went down, then Warner Brothers just made the decision high up within the company to end the series after the end of that season. That's what happened. And he may not have been informed of that. If he wasn't, that's news to me. I didn't know it. And I've talked to him many times over the course of the years, but he never told me that.
Yeah, I think he even discussed it on his archive of television interview that nobody had told him anything.
Hmm.
It's interesting. Maybe just an oversight, we'll say, at this particular time.
Well, that's a serious oversight if that's the case, but I don't know. I can't answer that. I don't, I've come to think of it, I'm not positive anyone told me that, to be really honest about it. I was busy doing other things. I just never got a call to come back.
and he had even said, I know in one interview we got into it at one point about what had happened there, and he said when the series came back, he was a little angry that they didn't ask him to come back.
He was very mad about that. I know that. That's the fact.
Yeah. So I guess that's the way it goes. But how did you meet the judge, Judge Wapner?
I had been working, and you may not know anything about what I did, but I was a television newsman. I had worked for years in Washington, D.C. for the CBS television and radio stations in Washington, and then gone to CBS television in Los Angeles, where I hosted a magazine series, much like 60 Minutes. And that series came to an end. It was shortly after that. I had a very good friend of mine from CBS. He and I started a production company in Los Angeles, and we had come up with a really neat idea for something that we thought the motion picture industry could benefit from. And the bottom line is we created a really unique tool for the marketing of movies on television news, and it became huge. We became the biggest producer of the making of movies in Hollywood. And I was in the midst of doing that when they were doing the People's Court a year later, and someone recommended me to Ralph Edwards, the legendary Ralph Edwards, who, was one of the big producers in Hollywood from the 1940s on up into the 70s and 80s. He was most famous for his series, This Is Your Life. Anyway, Ralph had a partner named Stu Billett, and they were the producers of the People's Court. I got a call from Ralph Edwards one afternoon. I mean, I'm sitting at my desk working on something. The phone rings, and the lady says, Ralph Edwards would like to talk to you. I thought, oh, my God, that's like God calling, And I called him, and he asked if I'd come over and have a meeting with him. And I went over and met with Ralph Edwards, and he said, this is what we're doing, and we think you'd be great for this job on the People's Court. Would you be willing to do it? And he said, it's not, time-wise, we need you one day a week. Because that's the way they tape the People's Court, just one day a week in the studio. So I said yes, and that's how I got hired. We started the series. I met Judge Wapner on the first day we started to tape. And, what's funny is so many people thought I was a lawyer and that I had a legal background, and I'm not a lawyer at all. I mean, I've learned a lot about the law from my 12 years on the series, but I don't have a law background. But anyway, that's how it started.
What kind of guy was he when the camera was not rolling?
Well, there's one thing that was mentioned in that CNN profile you aired a couple of minutes ago that the reporter didn't point out. Judge Wapner was the presiding judge. This is when he retired and left the bench. He had been for a couple of years, the presiding judge of the L.A. County Superior Court. That's the largest court system in the United States. He was the boss of over 200 judges in that court system. I mean, he was the guy. He was the top judge. So when he came to the People's Court, he was insistent that the television show be run almost exactly like his courtroom. And what's really interesting is we weren't taping a television series, per se. We were taping cases, lawsuits. We would go into a studio, and in one basically eight-hour day, we would essentially tape 10 different lawsuits, small claims lawsuits. And later on, those lawsuits would be mixed and matched by the producers in the editing room to make a television show, because essentially each show had two cases. So it's not like, it wasn't like it was you were going into, tape an episode of The Price is Right or some other television series. This was all really just legal mumbo-jumbo going on, lawsuits. And so that's the way it was run. You treated Judge Wapner like a judge. He was, good morning, Your Honor. How are you, sir? I never called him Joe for the 12 years that the series was on the air. I didn't call him Joe until after the series had ended, when I'd get together with him. He was all business. But at the same time, I mean, he would crack jokes. He could be a very funny guy. And I remember once going to a Halloween party at his house. Most of the staff was invited. We all went. And when you came to the door, he and his wife greeted you. They were dressed up like Minnie and Mickey Mouse. He had rabbit ears on and short pants. It was hilarious. So he could be that kind of a fun guy as well. But I must say, around the courtroom, during the studios, it was pretty serious, and he was pretty straight.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because what I found fascinating about the judge was when you would watch the People's Court, it wasn't obviously done for comedy, but yet at that same time, if Johnny Carson would ask him to come on and settle a case between he and David Letterman or Joan Rivers, same idea, he would do it. So he didn't take it too seriously.
Yeah, but he only did that once or twice. He was not one who enjoyed going on television shows as a guest. He did the Carson thing with Letterman. That was his biggest appearance on a show. But, I mean, he had lots of requests to appear on television shows, and they turned them all down. Basically, you really didn't see him in many other places. And that was kind of a fun thing for him. And, I mean, he could be fun. And you say the People's Court really wasn't set up for humor. It wasn't, but a lot of the cases had built-in humor with them.
Oh, absolutely.
And when something funny would happen in the courtroom, I mean, we'd all laugh. But at the same time, Judge Wapner could get very mad at litigants. I mean, I remember when Rusty the bailiff dropped a big clock. It became a pretty famous case because somebody was suing over an heirloom clock. And it was, you know, it was like about 3 feet tall, 2 feet wide, and the bailiff was Rusty was carrying it around the bench so Judge Wapner could take a look at it, and he dropped it. And it's a wonder the thing didn't smash into smithereens. Well, everybody in the courtroom broke out laughing, and, you know, Judge Wapner did too. It was a humorous event. So he could be funny and laugh, but he really did demand decorum in the courtroom. He expected respect, and he got mad when he didn't get the proper respect. I mean, he would fire off at the people, you know, litigants who just weren't acting properly, or who weren't dressed properly. He hated that, too. And another thing he hated was, you know, there was a term people used to use all the time. Some people still do, but you'd hear people talking about, well, when I went to do thus and such, you know, and I did this or that, you know, they keep throwing in, you know. That infuriated him. And if a litigant was doing that quite often, he would literally slap his hand down on the desk and say, don't say that. Don't tell me I know because I don't know. Cut it out. You know?
Well, you know, I want to ask you about his relationship with Rusty the bailiff, because the last time we had the judge on, I asked him this question. I want to play this clip. This is from a few years ago, and I think it kind of examines the relationship on the People's Court. Here's Judge Wapner just a few short years ago.
Want to talk about a couple of your old friends, Doug Llewellyn.
What do you want to know about him?
What are your memories of him?
I think he did a good job of interviewing people.
Did you like him as a person?
Yes.
Rusty the bailiff.
It's the greatest.
Why did you have such a good relationship with him?
Well, he was on my side. He was a natural.
He really had a close relationship there, it seemed like.
You know, I got to tell you something. When did you do that? About a year and a half or 2 years ago?
About 3 years ago.
Well, you know, Judge Wapner, it wasn't widely known, but he had had a minor stroke.
Yeah, he had
talked. And it affected his speech.
Yeah, he had talked about it in that interview.
And I got to tell you, I mean, that was not the Judge Wapner you normally heard.
No.
He was in the beginning of the decline of his life at that point. That wasn't the robust Judge Wapner that I know. And I can tell you this, Rusty and Joe, I'm calling him Joe now, Rusty and Judge Wapner were very close friends. Rusty had been the bailiff in Judge Wapner's courtroom in the Superior Court. So they had been together a long time, and it was Judge Wapner who recommended Rusty for the job on the People's Court. So it's a wonder he didn't, you know, tell you a lot more about Rusty, because they knew each other very, very well. And they were really dear friends.
Yeah, and
so,
you know...
I'm surprised he did that interview with you, quite frankly. He should not have done that.
Well, interesting. He had come on, I think, to talk about the stroke. And I think that was where that came from.
Yeah. I'm surprised you got him on the air. I'm not kidding. I'm surprised.
Yeah. Well, he had come on a lot before that, and I think he was okay with it. He just, this is something he had gone through, and I think he was trying to deal with it. Do you think that he changed? Do you think there would be courtroom shows today without Judge Wapner?
That's hard to say. Who knows? I mean, there was a guy who worked for Ralph Edwards Productions who had an idea for this kind of, or he's a friend. He knew Ralph well. He knew Stu Billett well. Brought the idea to Stu Billett, and Stu went to Ralph, and they decided to take a flyer and try it. That was in 1981. There have been so many different kind of ideas that have, you know, been generated in television over the years. I got to think somewhere along the line somebody might have tried this, but there's no guarantee. Who knows?
When you think about him after the People's Court, you say that the relationship changed a little bit. What was he like after that?
He was delightful. I mean, he and his wife were just—they were delightful people. I had been an acquaintance. I had been a friend, a good friend of Judge Wapner's for a long time. It's not like I saw him, you know, every week or every month. I'd see him maybe a year, and then 2 years would go by, and I'd see him. I'd drop by to see him, say hi, see how he's doing. He was great. He was as friendly and as nice as he could be, and. That judge persona had kind of disappeared. Do you know what I mean? He was kind of a more normal guy at that point.
Do you have a...
He was a good guy, no question about it. But people don't understand how big he was, how famous he was. You know, there was a survey at one point taken, I think it was in 1989. That was a year that we took the series on the road. And it was the Washington Post did the survey, and they found that two-thirds of those surveyed were not able to name any of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court. Not any of them. But 54% of them could name Judge Wapner.
Yeah.
So, and not only that, but to give you an idea of how effective the series was, it was that same year that they issued the fact that cases in small claims courts across the country had practically doubled in the years since the People's Court went on the air. And that's all because of the popularity of the show. I know that the show really educated a lot of people in this country about the existence of the small claims court system. Maybe they didn't know it existed. And not only that, but it educated people on what you had to do to win a lawsuit, what kind of evidence you needed, and how you had to have, you know, testimonials or affidavits notarized to bring them to court. And not only that, but how you had to treat the judge and what not to say to the judge. Those are the kind of things people learned. And I think that's why we had such a large audience and why the show took off. And, you know, it hadn't changed. Not only, I mean, the case is much the same, but people are still learning about how the court system works from watching all of the shows that are on. You learn by watching Judge Judy. You learn by watching Marilyn on the People's Court. Let's face it, court shows have become a genre, and they're very popular. Who knew the People's Court would still be on 32 years later?
Yeah,
TV's amazing.
It is amazing. Do you have a favorite episode of the Judge Wapner version of the People's Court?
Well, the most famous one I remember is when I got bitten on the air by a dog. We got a lot of mileage out of that. I mean, there were other TV shows who used that clip. It was used on one of the Carson shows showing me getting bitten by a dog. The people had, they had neighbors who had... One of the neighbor's child had a BB gun and had shot out the eye of their puppy and did not want to pay the vet bills. So they sued them in court, and they should have. But when they came to court, they brought the dog with them, and the dog was a little nervous and a little uneasy, and they brought the dog in before the judge so he could see. And then when they brought, you know, they brought the dog out, and I was talking to him in the hallway afterward. The dog was knee-high. His eyeballs were looking at my knee, and I shifted my knee at some point while I was chatting with one of the litigants, and he just lit out and bit me in the knee. It was caught live on camera. That's the one I remember the most. I mean, we only did, you know, several, 2,500 cases, something like that. Close to 3,000, I guess, really. So there were so many different cases, and it was everything you could think of.
Did going from a judge to becoming, everybody, like you say, everybody knew Judge Wapner more than who was on the Supreme Court, did fame change him?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, no, it may have, but he was still the same stern judge around the People's Court as he was. Because, I mean, everybody knew him, and we would go places to appear. I remember we went to Chicago and rode in the St. Patty's Day parade. We all had, but we were on a float, riding down the, you know, down Michigan Avenue in Chicago, and he was eating it up. Everybody was loving him, and you know. So he enjoyed the fame, but no, it didn't change him. Quite frankly, it didn't change him. I don't think so. Scott, listen, I'd love to spend all day.
No,
with
I enjoy. I'm glad you came on.
I have another obligation I have to go to. So yeah, I'd be delighted to talk with you later. He was a great guy, and we all miss him. And but he had a great life. Hey, to last to 97 years old. That's pretty remarkable.
97's not bad.
You know?
That's right. Doug Llewellyn, I thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Hey, take
care. Good
luck. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Doug Llewellyn, one of the all-time greats from the People's Court. What a great great guy he is. Again, if anybody has any comments or memories of Judge Joseph Wapner, give me a call, 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. Or if you have any questions to... questions or comments, I guess it would be, for the first interview today with Eleanor Cliff from the Daily Beast about what's going on tonight with Donald Trump's speech or what's going on in the government, give me a call there too. 740-383-9944, and we'll get you up on the air. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Scott.
Hey.
You know, something happened. I went up and had a little lunch, and my wife really surprised me.
How's that?
She always goes in and looks at the news on the, you know, on her computer. And she was a big, big Hillary fan. I know she was really hurt when Hillary didn't win. But there's this news item came on, and she was totally disgusted. It involved Trump. And the people she was disgusted with were the reporters. Apparently he had gone to just to have a meal in a restaurant. And he'd ordered a steak. And when the steak came out, he asked if they would please bring him some ketchup. And they were making a big deal out of that. That's the kind of nonsense that I think would repulse anybody that had the subject to some jerk of a reporter who has to make a big deal of what he eats.
Now, who was reporting that? That seems...
I have no idea. It was on a CNN News thing.
It was on CNN that he had ketchup.
This was on, it was on her computer.
Well, see,
but, she hates Trump, but in this instance, she says that was totally uncalled for. Those people should leave him alone. It's none of their business what he has to eat and whether he likes ketchup on his steak or not.
Now, what was the connotation behind ketchup on the steak?
What a nerd there. He likes ketchup on his steak.
Oh.
That's ridiculous.
Well, that is, you know, it's silly,
and
though,
that
but...
that falls in there like the one of the nude pictures of his wife and stuff.
Well,
when you just hop on a guy about nothing, stuff like that, he's not going to respect you as a reporter.
Well, you know what I think has happened, though, and I don't like those stories about the nude picture of the wife, or I don't care how he eats his steak or any of that, but I think what happens is it doesn't go both ways, and this is what I was talking about a few weeks ago on the air. It's not about liking President Trump or agreeing with him. That's not what we're getting at here, because whether he has ketchup on his steak or whether his wife took nude pictures does not affect how he governs, but conversely, how he feels about the media and what he thinks is fake and not fake and barring people from his press conferences, that doesn't affect how he governs either.
No,
so,
I think it's just a fallback, though, from all these instances of guys, using really you know, they serve no purpose other than to embarrass the guy.
Yeah, but if he got up there,
I'd be mad.
Yeah, but if he, well, but they're mad. See, that's the climate that's been created. Because, see, if he got up there, there is no genuine reporter in the world. If Donald Trump stood up at the press conference and said that somebody would report that I had ketchup on my steak, that's trivial, that's stupid, that's dumb. Every reporter in that room is going to agree with that. The problem is he gets up there and calls them fake news about true things. And then but people follow and believe that. There is a gap here, and that's what's creating stories like the one you just described. And that is what is unfortunate. People think there's no repercussion from what he's doing with the media. That's the repercussion, because he is doing something that is very negative. He's doing something that's very negative. When you go as far as to call the media the enemy of the people, I think that's a far more vulgar and rude thing to say and report on than whether somebody has ketchup on their steak.
There should be, a little better way of doing stuff than that. In other words, he attacks them, so they got to attack back with some minute nonsense.
Well, I don't know if it was maybe it was an attack, and I'm not saying it wasn't. But I think the problem is we need to get back to meet normal media, where it is, we're going to report the facts, you're not going to call us liars when it's true. Now, if it's untrue, say liar all day. But don't, this alternative facts, and this sending people out to say things that aren't true, and this bashing the media, it's all become, and also Donald Trump set up whether it's right or wrong is not for me to decide, but he commented on Megyn Kelly's looks. He commented on Rosie O'Donnell's looks. He comments on Hollywood all the time. You know, you can't do that and then expect people not to do it to you.
Well, like I say, I always felt the press felt that they were, beyond nonsense. But in reality, they aren't. They're nothing more than the, what can we find on this guy? And it's silliness.
That's a false. It's a silly story, that ketchup on steak. I wouldn't have reported on it. But I guess.
Well, they did the same thing. Essentially, the same thing with, what's his name, our governor, when they talked about, he was trying to talk and eat at the same time, and oh boy, he looked bad in that.
But you know something,
get back to real life.
That's a good. I'm glad you brought that up, because do you know where that started? The media didn't make fun of him. The media just reported it. There is not a media source legitimate. CNN, New York Times, the network newscast. None of those ever made fun of Kasich eating. They reported while he was eating, because that's where he wanted to do the interview. Trump's the one who went after him. What a slob. Those sort of things. Now, see, there you go. Trump did it. But now he doesn't want to take that same thing.
But they didn't hesitate to print it.
Print that he said Kasich was a slob?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was done in town halls. I don't think anybody ever interviewed and said, well, what do you think of Kasich's eating? I think he did that in interviews. See, that's one of the problems with interviews, too. When you let somebody on live, you don't know what they're going to say. So this is the slippery slope we're on. This is why I never liked having this station referred to as the Hillary Clinton Network, or being partisan, or hating Trump, because none of that is true in the essence of life. What we are doing is reporting. Now, do people come on here and give comments that are probably partisan? Sure they do. But do people call in and give partisan comments? Sure they do. But the essence of the story, which is where we start, is factual. And I don't think we've ever done one of those trivial stories. So that's what I don't understand. The people who support Trump seem to have this idea that the media is just out to get him. The media is in the United States. The media is governed by the federal government. What good would it do for the media to be out to get him?
Oh, I don't think it does anyone any good.
Right, and in general, they're not. They're trying to do their job, but he... You know where it all... It started Inauguration Day. I mean, when he blatantly lied about the size of the crowd. Now, is that a minute thing? Yes. But the story is that a man who just became the most powerful man in the free world, his first morning on the job, in a visit to the CIA, standing in front of the memorial wall, that's what he talks about.
Hmm.
That's odd.
No, that wasn't smart on his part.
No, but why does he do that?
You know, was it really important enough to even report that?
I think they were reporting that it was first day in office, going to the CIA. He'd had a little battle with them. He was apparently going to give a nice speech, and then he did that. And then it was hard to ignore it because then he sent his press secretary out. I mean, he didn't just say it there, sent his press secretary out to blatantly lie. Why do that? I to this day, that's what I don't understand about Donald Trump. It's not about like or dislike. It's not about policy. It's all about why does he feel the need to comment on these little things that don't mean anything?
I suppose in his view, it's a personal attack. And he's not the type of person. He's the bully type that always has to have the last, you know, the loud and everything. And it's silly. It's no doubt about it.
He
has a lot of blemishes, but I think if the press were a little more prudent and what's worth reporting, there's a lot of stuff that's totally not worth reporting.
No, the ketchup story is dumb.
I'm not even sure if that business with the golden showers was true or not.
But you notice, now see, that's interesting. Now here, now this is a good point. What you just mentioned was never, because the two people he dislikes right now, the two press organizations, are the New York Times and CNN. Okay. Now, the New York Times and CNN both reported that there was a dossier, and they both reported that it said that the Trump campaign had constant communication with Russia.
Yeah.
To this day, neither CNN on their website television program or the New York Times on their website written paper has ever reported about what you just said. That came out on an internet site, and it's never been talked about on CNN. It's never been brought up. It's never been printed in the New York Times because it's never been fact-checked. So why is he after them? They're not reporting that. He can believe that guy over in the UK and leaking it to the website that did... I forget the website that printed it.
I thought it was something in Britain.
Yeah, something like that. He can blame them, but he chooses to blame CNN and New York Times. Now, it seems to me like if they really wanted to get Trump, they would have printed that. It wouldn't have been the ketchup steak story. They would have printed that, because if you want to embarrass somebody, that's a way to do it.
Oh, certainly.
But I don't think they're doing it. I don't think they are out to get him. I think they're out to report the facts, but he has some kind of crusade in his mind that he's... The same thing with health care. What's he going to say tonight? I mean, honestly, hadn't happened yet. We know it's going to be about health care, immigration, and the budget.
Yeah.
He says he's not going to cut entitlements, but he's going to raise defense spending by $50 billion. Okay, where's the money coming from?
Yeah, that's one thing he's proposed that I'm totally against. I don't see no point in. He's going to take us the way Russia went.
Okay, and then let's move on to the other one tonight, immigration. How is he going to have the police force enforce this? The staff is going to have to be so large to get these people. That's going to be difficult. Where's he going to get the money for that? And number three, maybe the most important, where's he going to get the money to build the wall? What was that? $10 billion? Over $10 billion, I think?
Oh, yeah.
Where's that coming from? On top of the...
Again, it is something that he proposed that he should drop.
And then number three, the health care thing, what is his plan?
He's sort of at the mercy of, Congress. on that.
Well, and the Congress is at the mercy of themselves because they all can't agree on anything.
I know.
So the chances of Obamacare going away are right now about slim and none.
It'll probably take at least a year and a half.
You know, I truly don't think it'll... But if you would have asked me before the Jim Jordan interview, would it go away, I would have said yes. After that, I realize what the problem is. The problem is that all the Democrats, even though they're in the minority, are not going to vote for any plan because they want Obamacare to stay.
Yeah, and just the retribution for Obama's problems with them.
And then all the Republicans, there are three plans. You've got Ryan's plans, Trump's plan, and Rand Paul's plan, and you can't get a majority when you split your vote three ways.
Yep.
So I don't see it going anywhere. And none of them are going to repeal it. You know, that's also something very interesting. They voted to repeal it 60 times when Obama was president, and he vetoed it every time. They've had 40 days. They haven't voted to repeal it once.
No, because they knew it wasn't going to happen.
Right. Earlier. It was a campaign. They never had a plan.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't think it'll go away. But maybe I'm just stupid here, because my plan is still this. Why don't they repeal it, but put in the... You can put anything in a bill. Why don't they put, we'll repeal Obamacare. Okay, we fulfilled our campaign promise. But it does not repeal, it does not revert, until the first day the new plan goes into effect.
Once it's enacted, then you can move on.
Right. So why don't they do that?
Well, it's a lot of people expect a... One problem is a lot of people believe guys like Trump when they say something.
I think there's some smoke in it.
And they got to learn that's just politics.
Yeah, but people got to beware, because here's what I think they're thinking. I think a plan will be presented tonight, and they'll say, oh, that's the plan we want. Because Trump supporters are Trump supporters.
Yeah.
And then they'll say, let's repeal it. So you repeal it, it's gone. Then they go to vote on the replacement, and it doesn't go through.
Mm-hmm.
You really got to watch that. And I think that's what these people at the town halls are doing. Repeal it all day long, but make sure that it does not go away until the first day the replacement plan goes into effect.
Yeah, there were some bad aspects to it, but it's certainly better than nothing, I guess.
Well, the pre-existing condition, I mean, even the thing, if you lost 26-year-old staying on your insurance, we could still probably live through that.
I was going to say, that one to me seemed a very unnecessary thing.
Yeah, we could probably live through that. But I tell you what we're not going to live through. We're not going to live through the pre-existing condition deletion.
Yeah.
Because you've given too many people health care now, and to yank it in the middle of their treatment isn't going to work. So
I never understood why we are so anxious to make sure we don't offend the insurance people.
Well, because the insurance lobby is a big lobby.
They add a lot to the cost.
They're a big lobby.
I know they're a big lobby, but there are some lobbies that you should just ignore.
Well, I'll give you a brief thing here on the, because a lot of people don't know this, and I just happened to be around in college at the time. When I first started going to college, you went to college, no big deal. And then somewhere about, I'm going to say 2002, 2003, college got this idea that if you don't have a health care plan, you cannot attend class. Ohio State had this. And what the deal was, we'll offer you a health care plan, and we'll give you a chance to take a loan out to pay for it. But if you can't prove to us that you have your health care, it was something like by the third or fourth week, we have to get you out of here. Now, I never understood that, but that's what that 26-year-old thing is. Ohio State wasn't the only school to do it, I'm sure, but that's just where I was at the time.
Yeah.
But I never understood that. I never understood why a college mandated that you as a student had to have health insurance.
Yeah. Now, I don't agree with, that they do have the critical thing happen to them when they don't have the insurance. Again, if your car breaks, you can't go out and get a policy on it, or a car is in a wreck. You can't go out and get a policy. You rolled the dice and you lost. And, you know, it's not a, it probably was not a condition until after they, you know, well, after the guy turned down the insurance.
Well, I
so
think
I never really agreed that he should have the right to get insurance at that point then.
Well, the problem is, honestly, is that as opposed to car insurance is very competitive. Health insurance is not. Health insurance, if you are not employed, you have very few choices.
Mm-hmm.
So,
or retired.
Right. So I think that's the problem. It was so costly. People weren't choosing not to be insured because we just don't want to be insured. They were choosing not to be insured because it was such a great cost. They could pay the doctor appointment or they could pay the hospital visit cheaper than they could pay that premium every year. Car insurance isn't like that. Car insurance is very competitive. There are so many people in the car insurance business. Health insurance is not going to be like that because health insurance is not based, it doesn't have the same basing that car insurance has.
Mm-hmm.
So it's our home insurance. It's, you know, when you consider a woman having a baby as a pre-existing condition, well, what can you do?
Yeah.
You know, you're kind of up the creek.
There's a lot of problems with it. And I think, I know the intent of the requirement for the to have insurance was they would have the young guys that are feeling good now, and they think, you know, why should I be forced to get it? Well, that's the only way it can be affordable for everyone.
Well, see, that was Obamacare. See, that's what the Republicans don't like, though, because they're saying insurance should not be mandated. You should not be forced.
Right.
So what do you do? I don't know. We've run out of time, but hopefully we'll continue this tomorrow. Thank you for calling in.
Okay. Bye.
And that is all the time we have for today's program. We have had a great time. Hope you come back tomorrow. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Radio LP, Marion, Ohio, 107.1 FM.